Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the 42nd episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid. We're finished with the big scene-by-scene deep dive look at Hamlet, but there's so many other adaptations that we never covered. So today we're looking at 2018's stage production of Hamlet with Andrew Scott in the role, with network all-star Ryan Daly. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thank you for having me. I'm a little confused by your intro. I really thought we were talking about the Taylor Swift song, The Fate of Ophelia. That's what I prepared for.
Yeah, I am aware that that exists. I couldn't sing it. Obviously, this is something that you and I discussed before, regardless of your gag there. And you're the one who told me or asked me if I if I'd seen it, if I liked it, or so. You clued me in on this one, and I'm glad you did. I really enjoyed it, and I'm happy to have a chance to discuss it.
Yeah.
But this is actually your first time on the show, and I usually have like this little questionnaire for newbies. We ask, what is your link to Shakespeare? I mean, I know you've been on the boards, you've been a thespian, but have you done Shakespeare? No. Have you?
I've done, like, just for, like, class projects, like, class performances, both in high school and college, like, never, like, a full-fledged stage production of any of his works. But for, like, various classes in high school, I had to do a few scenes. Or in college, I took a whole semester-long Shakespeare class that kind of went through a lot of his greatest hits. And I did a scene from Henry IV. I think, I don't even remember where I first heard the name or, like, knew of, like, this figure, this literary figure who was just kind of everywhere. But the first time I read one of his plays was in eighth grade. We read The Taming of the Shrew. And my wonderful eighth grade teacher, Mrs. Wells, showed us the episode of Moonlighting that parodied that play, which was a lot of fun. My freshman year, we read Romeo and Juliet. And that was right around the same time that the Baz Luhrmann movie came out. So just because that time of having that visual reference keyed me into the dialogue and the text and the language a lot better. So I think, unlike a lot of my high school peers, I was a lot more receptive and open to Shakespeare. Even when I didn't get the language or the similes or the metaphors, I was interested in finding out. So I really dove into that much more aggressively.
I think I saw that Moonlighting episode live as it came out back in the day. It might be like one of my first Shakespearean things that I ever saw, right?
I'm sure for a lot of people, that's the case.
It's that or Gilligan's Island, apparently.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite play from The Bard?
It's probably Macbeth. I shouldn't have said that one. I definitely lean toward the tragedies more than the histories or the comedies. And maybe more of that is just the comedies don't age as well in like contemporary parlance and what we think of as humorous. But the tragedy, I do like Romeo and Juliet. I do like Othello and King Lear. But I think probably the Scottish play and Hamlet are my favorites.
Well, yeah, you saved yourself there. Do you have a favorite version of Hamlet?
Well, I didn't want to spoil, but it's probably this one.
Okay.
But I've only known about this one for a year or two. Prior to that, gosh, I could tell you that Throne of Blood, the Kurosawa movie, is my favorite version of Macbeth. Don't know if his version of Hamlet would be out there. So it might be Kenneth Branagh's?
Yeah, yeah. But I think this one is definitely top five, maybe even top three of those that I've seen. So it's definitely worthy. For people who want to watch it, it is available, or else we would have been up a creek. But it was produced by the Almeida Theatre in London, directed by Robert Icke, filmed by the BBC. That version of it is available on YouTube. You just Google Hamlet Andrew Scott, and it'll come up. It'll be the 3-hour clip.
If you don't have like a premium membership of YouTube, you get ads inserted all of the time throughout the whole 3-hour thing, like right in the middle of some of the soliloquies. It's like, oh my God.
May I recommend an ad blocker while you watch this? Because that's going to be tedious.
It also has an IMDb page so you can find like link to some of the cast members and everything like that. Although it is not complete because a lot of the musical credits are not included in there.
It takes place in modern day Denmark. you have video screens over the stage, which are used as part of the action. It can be like the hyper surveillance. They had that concept in the Tenant Hamlet as well, but not quite done like this. You see them as like security monitors, but it also becomes media. It becomes like the TV screen giving you the news about Fortinbras and that kind of thing. And it has under that a screen that can become transparent. And so you can, it creates depth and you can see what's going on elsewhere in Elsinore, yeah, type thing. So as a look, it's kind of bare bones. It'd be mostly black with a little bit of furniture,
right,
but you've also got that depth to it. So as far as the look goes, it's modern dress. Modern technology is part of the storytelling. It's also a very spare production that it's about the acting, I think, more than, right, anything. So did you like this, the setting for it, the sort of premise for it?
I did. I liked the sort of modern update because of what you mentioned, using the security cameras, particularly in Act 1, Scene 1, like when we jump in, like with the whole, because the play starts with the two sentries, the two guards, like talking about their watch. And when you introduce it as security guards looking at camera feeds all over the building, the castle, whatever, you know, meant to be. I just think that translated really, really well. So I liked putting it in the modern setting. I liked you were able to see, you know, the video footage of Fortinbras and the funeral for the Hamlet Sr. at the beginning. So a lot of that stuff just helped convey more of the exposition through the use of that modernity. The one thing that I think I wasn't going to mention this at the end, but once you introduce a kind of modern sensibility, like the use of guns as weapons, I think by the end, when you get to the actual fencing match, that aspect becomes anachronistic and a little bit silly.
Did you call it fencing?
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's in the text. You can't really change it, but it's kind of like, that's a weird thing to do when you have access to other things. I mean, I know it was ostensibly, nominally supposed to be a friendly duel, but...
In a friendly duel, if both of these guys practice fencing, then fine. You know, to me, that made sense. But there are some stains on this that I will discuss. I mean, there are changes made to the play. That's the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
To make it fit 3 hours and so on.
Right.
They apparently cobbled together the text from different quartos and the first folio. And I'm really not an expert in that kind of thing.
Right.
It's a blind spot for me, like which versions. I use always the accepted version, whatever the, I guess it's the folio, I don't know. So when there's changes, I notice some of these are structural. I don't know what parts of it are actually from a different version that came down to from the ages or which ones are changes made today. Certainly, they've made the vocabulary more modern, mm-hmm, like or becomes over or, you know, like they'll change some of those pronunciations to make them more modern. That's certainly more modern. But they've also got things like moving some of the scenes, like To Be or Not to Be is earlier, and I've seen that before. So I think that's probably from a quarto, I suppose. Mm.
There's a scene at the end between Horatio and Gertrude.
I so hate it, Ryan.
Really? Okay, yeah. Because I think it definitely changes your look at Gertrude in the very end of the play. And I was like, I never read this part. And then I looked up, I was like, okay, maybe that's in another one of the quartos or something else. But
my problem isn't that it suddenly makes Gertrude more with Hamlet, because mm-hmm, that's an interpretation that you can have regardless.
Right.
Does she know that she's sacrificing herself or not? You know, so, but this sort of sets it up a little more. We never find out in the play in the normal play, because she gets the letter from Hamlet, what is in that letter. So this sort of covers that. In a way,
mm-hmm,
instead of having Horatio read the letter by himself, he goes to Gertrude and he paraphrases it. And all of that to me sounds like, I'm sorry, it sounds like doggerel. I don't know if it's, you know, from the earlier version, if Shakespeare ever penned these words. I guess maybe experts, since we use the folio, experts would say no. But it just sounds so wrong. I don't know. It was like the weakest bit for me, because it just felt like somebody was doing cod Shakespeare.
I must soothe and please him for a while, for murderous minds are always jealous. But no, you're not Horatio where Hamlet is.
Yes, madam, and he hath appointed me to meet him on the east side of the city tomorrow morning.
Oh, fail not, good Horatio, and withal commend me a mother's love to him, but bid him be wary of his presence, lest he fail in that he goes about.
Yeah, I get that.
Is Stanley's Thor. that's the one stain on this play for me, is like that, the way they collapsed that into that moment. It sounded like the actors or something, which, damn, we forgot the text. And this happened to me in the past. I've played in a Molière play, and I completely forgot my text at some point. This is like back in university. And I suddenly went into this, it sounds like Molière, but it isn't. I'm just trying to cover until I get to the next bit that I remember. And no one was the wiser. Maybe the professor, I don't know, but it just sounds like that.
I like the idea of the scene between Horatio and Gertrude. For one thing, it did expedite things. It kind of cut through some of it to kind of shorten it, but also just giving these two people close to Hamlet who are, I don't think they ever have a scene together or any encounter. And this being the first one was a little bit interesting. And I do like giving a little bit more. I do like the perspective on Gertrude, the way this informs her behavior during the last scene at the duel. It was jarring in a couple of ways. I was like, I never read this scene. And I'm also like, just like you, I'm like, this sounds vaguely Shakespearean, but it also sounds like the production company might have written this scene for them.
It's not too great. They do have scenes together before. Like, he's always present when Ophelia's going mad.
Oh, yeah. That's right. He's the one who announces that.
Yeah. And there are cut bits. I'm kind of impressed that they kept things like Ronaldo and the speech that the first player gives. Those are often cut, but I think they're crucial to the understanding of the themes and some of the characters. So I'm happy to see them there, but they did, like, they cut within scenes. They put less dialogue. It does make, you know, like the Gravedigger and Osric more serious as a result. Like, you lose the comedy of those moments.
Yeah.
But that's like a minor point. Like, to me, that doesn't hurt the play. Let's talk about Hamlet, the casting, the performance. The main thing here is that they have Andrew Scott, who people may remember if you don't recognize the name, not Adam Scott from Parks and Recs.
Right. I have gotten the two wrong before when I was describing one of those.
Exactly. Me too. So that's what I'm saying. But he's Moriarty in the Sherlock series with Cumberbatch. Mm-hmm. He's the sexy priest in Fleabag.
Yep.
I think those are the two things that most people will remember him most for.
He's in one of the recent Bond movies. Was it Spectre? I think he's in Spectre. Yeah.
He plays C, but I guess he's a Q type character.
Yeah. And I actually, the first place I would have seen him, I didn't know who he was, so I didn't really notice him. But he was in one episode of Band of Brothers, which I had watched back in the early 2000s. He was in the episode that takes place on D-Day, even though so that would have been the first time I saw him. But the first time I really took note of him was as Moriarty opposite Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch. I thought his performance of that was just awesome.
Same. I mean, he's great in that. And he's sort of like this kind of character, the same way that David Tennant seemed perfect for Hamlet because he played the Doctor, a sort of wild genius.
Yeah.
Very volatile. Same thing here, right? It's like Andrew Scott fits that bill.
He has kind of a more boyish face. He looks naturally younger. And I think that helps to understand the youth and inexperience of Hamlet, like as opposed to Kenneth Branagh's version where it's like, I'm sorry, is Hamlet 50 in this production? Like, what?
He's nowhere near 30. That's for sure. Right. But that often happens because they use more mature actors to play Hamlet, because it is such a complex role.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem play as well. It's like, what age is he, et cetera.
I remember you coming to that in one of the episodes you did of the show. It's like, wait a minute, a lot of the dialogue like he's going off to college or something. Is he a teenager? Wait, at the end, the Gravedigger says he's 30. Has time passed that much? But yeah.
Well, we don't know because time is out of joint, which is obviously one of the themes.
True.
And one of the quirks of this particular Hamlet is that he's always playing with his watch.
A lot of the characters do.
Yeah. Well, the watch becomes a symbol for many things. It becomes it becomes life because I gave you life. The father, it's like
Polonius gives the watch to Laertes at the beginning as sort of a going away present.
And I thought, okay, this watch, Hamlet's watch, is the same. It was given to him by his father, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, when they die, they remove
the
watch.
They pass the watch, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that moment, which is a fairly surprising staging solution at the end. But what did you think of the performance itself?
I loved it. And that was really one of the things that made me... Well, first, it was the thing that brought this to my attention. I don't remember what it was, but I just saw they clipped version of Andrew Scott doing the to be or not to be speech, and even like only like the first half of it. And I was like, this is a really good performance of that soliloquy. And then I looked it up and I watched the entire thing. But he has, in terms of the language at least, and I think this goes to most of the whole production, there is a conversational tone and delivery to a lot of the language and the way certain words or phrases are enunciated or stressed. To me, this just seemed more easily digestible. And even if I hadn't been familiar with the play, I think like I was like, oh, I know exactly what he's saying from this delivery. And I might not have felt that way the way other actors deliver the lines. It just sort of cuts to the meat of what each little word or phrase is saying. And but he's also expressing the emotion. He's very emotive. He's teary-eyed. He's wrathful. He screams when it seems appropriate, sometimes lashing out and then coming back down like whip-snap because you see the madness, whether that's pretend or whether that's legitimate. He even calls attention to it when he screams out vengeance and then like really softly goes, what an ass am I? Certainly at times might come across as whiny. I even think maybe in his final speech as he's dying, that might have come across as a little bit too, I don't know, just whiny and upset for what was happening. But overall, yeah, I just thought the physical presence that he brought and just the way he delivered some of the lines just felt very informal, very just kind of natural, not theatrical, not staged, not the Shakespearean, but almost, I can't come up with a better word than just natural and conversational.
I think you're right. It's like he's really speaking to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
The aside isn't just like I'm speaking to myself or, I don't know, to some omniscient divine presence or something. It's
yeah. And with the soliloquies in particular, but I obviously the to be or not to be one is the most famous. That's kind of one of the ones that you key into. And that was my gateway to this particular version. But part of it was just like, it didn't sound like an actor had memorized this speech or like the thought was fully formed when he started speaking. He delivers it as if each part of this speech is occurring to him at that moment.
To die. To sleep. No more. And by asleep, to say, we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die. To sleep. To sleep. Perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. For in that sleep of death, what dreams may come?
Like, he just kind of throws his hands up. He's like, that's all we're talking about. Death, it's just going to sleep. And who wouldn't want to sleep through all of the injustices of the world? He's like, this is a much better option. To sleep, perchance to dream. He's like, even like shakes his head kind of like, he's like, wouldn't that be cool? And then his face just kind of drops and his eyes focus. And he's like, aye, there's the rub. That's the problem, is because we don't know what else there might be after death. That's the fear of the unknown that makes us struggle through life and suffer, you know, the pangs of misfortune, as he says. It's just kind of all of the crap that humans have to go through in life. It's because it's like the whole, it's kind of the myth of Sisyphus. It's like, why don't we just kill ourselves if life sucks? It's like, because maybe there's something after and it might be worse and you just don't know.
He discovers the text as he goes.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
That's the real magic here. I understand that some people might feel that by the end, it's a bit much, like the rhythm is slower whenever he speaks because he takes a break between different words as he searches for them. And I think what you're feeling about understanding the text better through his performance is that he puts in a lot of gestures, like he will mime the thing he's talking about in a way. And sometimes before he says the words. So that's like he's looking for something to say. What's the word? He mimes it. The gesture that you understand is also a gesture that inspires the next bit. Mm-hmm. He's discovering it, you know, as he goes, and that makes it like supernatural. Not supernatural, super, very natural. I think that's the real key to his performance here, is that idea. And I mean, it refreshes the text, right? Because it doesn't feel, like you said, it doesn't feel rehearsed. I think one of the other things I would say about his performance is that this is a very fragile Hamlet.
Yeah.
Usually, in most productions, when he comes back from exile, he's a different man. He's ready to take action. He's more calm and collected. He loses himself at some points. But, you know, by the time he's doing the apology, he seems very cold, reasoned, calculated. By that point, you have a hard time believing that he was ever really mad, and you think it was all a fake. Not in this one. I feel like when he returns from England, or not England, I guess he never got there. When he returns from exile, he is even worse. He's sort of manic. He's a lot more jittery. When he's doing his apology to Laertes, Laertes has the same look as when he saw his sister insane.
Right.
He's seeing the same thing. It's not the normal presentation. I'm thinking through this, he's not the only one. I feel like the actors really inspired themselves from true diagnoses, different diagnoses depending on the person. There's like a psychological truth that is not necessarily in every production.
Yeah, I agree. To the thing about his transformation for Act 5 when he comes back, the only thing that really kind of keys you into that is just the change of costume, because in the first four acts, he's wearing black, and when he comes back, he's wearing white, and that's the only real difference.
But otherwise, I think he's like even more on the edge. He hasn't gotten better, which is, you know, it's like he's magically better in most productions, not in this one. So I thought that was like a very interesting take where I believed, I mean, even early on, because the way they restructured the scenes, they call for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern earlier than than normal. So there's already something wrong. It's like, we want you to sound him and about what's going on with him. So I think this is a Hamlet who was already very much on the edge. Like, they didn't wait for him to start feigning madness. In other words, this must have already been in play.
Yeah.
That's a big difference from a lot of the productions, as people know. Let's talk about other characters, though. Obviously, I've got a list here. The cast list. What is it called? The dramatis personae. Claudius is played by Angus Wright. How is the villain in this for you?
I liked him. The first note I wrote down about him as I was rewatching this was horny. He's very affectionate, very touchy-feely with Gertrude. I think in particular when he's alone, when he gives his prayer, and the way they set up is Hamlet is on the stage with him pointing the gun at him, but when he is praying and talking about, you know, he even says he can't be forgiven because I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder. He goes, my crown, my ambition, and then he pauses before he says, and my queen. And I really think, like, he's hitting through all of it. Like, he loves Gertrude. And, like, I think because of the nature of the play, because he's the obvious villain, because Hamlet keeps calling him a villain and incestuous, talking about how he murdered his father and then Claudius murdered his brother and then took his wife, I think there's no real way of seeing, like, a sympathetic avenue into Claudius. And I'm not saying that I sympathize with him. But in this version, I really felt that he genuinely loved her. He really loved her. And I think at the end, as he's dying, he's reaching for her hand on the stage. And that was different than other productions that I remember seeing. And I thought that was an interesting take that gives him a little bit more humanity when he talks about, he's like, these things that I've done, but I can't give up myself for murdering him because I like the power, but I also, I'm doing it for her, in a sense. So I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely. They're always having sex. They're always making out.
Yeah.
So there's obviously something there. In the first scene, I mean, for me, Claudius has to be like the best Claudiuses. They don't put on villainy. They don't seem villainous, except you know they are sinister. I want them to be slick as balls, you know? So this guy is really slick. He's very charming. I think that's the key component to how he took power. There's some really good bits in the first scene that they have. We talk about the politics and then, so now, and he looks towards Hamlet and you think, okay, it's going to be the scene with Hamlet. Laertes. You know, it's like showing favor to Laertes as part of the sting that Hamlet has to feel. So there's that bit I liked. And then later, he uses the word affair, and he obviously puts quotation marks on it.
Nor have we here in Bard your better wisdoms, which have freely gone with this affair along.
So we know that this was maybe a pre-existing relationship before the death of the king, and he's not even hiding it.
Yeah.
He's gloating about his sexual impropriety. And later, you talked about the confessional scene. I mean, that is a major departure in terms of staging because they're doing it face-to-face. I was never sure at the beginning. It's like, well, do they know they're in each other's space? Is this really happening? It's staged as if he knows that Hamlet is there. Hamlet, they're speaking to each other and not to the void. He has a gun to his head. And he does the prayer, and he's almost expecting to get shot. When he doesn't get shot, and Hamlet says, well, you know, you're praying, so I can't send you to heaven. But then he goes, my prayers...
go up while my thoughts go down.
My thoughts remain below. The prayers without thoughts,
right.
Never to heaven go. And he's saying it to Hamlet. And he's like, I'm daring you. You weakling.
Yeah, he opens his jacket, like he's spreading his arms, like showing his chest. He's like, here I am. Here's the target. Aim true.
You're never going to do this, Hamlet. You weak little boy. That's what it is.
Yeah. And that part I kind of thought, I was like, okay, maybe this is in Hamlet's mind. That was a little bit ambiguous because there's also just the really dramatic cutaway when Hamlet has the gun on him. And then it's like, nope, we're in Gertrude's bedroom now.
And then, I mean, he just didn't shoot him. So he goes on to shoot Polonius, thinking maybe it's the king. So it's like he's very close to it and he's been dared to do it. And he still doesn't do it, which is Hamlet's whole character, you know, in the first three acts. So it's a very interesting, very, very interesting. And it shows how Claudius has this much power where his charisma basically stops the bullet from getting out of the gun. So I like that performance. I like the whole thing with Claudius was good. What did you think of Juliet Stevenson's Gertrude?
I mean, my notes for her initially were just tipsy and hungover. I thought she played that well in the first couple of scenes, like when they have to wake her up and everything and her hair is tussled. She's like, oh boy. I do think she plays it as true ignorance of the murder. And, you know, again, based on that final scene that we talked about, or the scene that we're not sure we feel about, well, I know that you hate it, but her reaction when Horatio tells her that Claudius planned to kill Hamlet in England, I liked her response to that. I'll say the only scene with her that I didn't like was when she delivers the news of Ophelia's suicide to Laertes.
Okay.
Given the news and given Laertes' state of mind, I mean, she comes off as very cold, and she's far away from him on the staging. She's very distant. And I thought if she loved them both almost like her surrogate children, she would have gotten up to Laertes and like held his face in her hands or something and like been like held him as she delivered this news very somberly. But
it's very theatrical.
Yeah. But instead, she downplays it and makes it almost kind of like not an afterthought, but just like her depression, her sadness about it is more than anybody else's. And I didn't like how cold she was in the delivery of that news. I did like his response because after she goes, she's like, Laertes, like she's drowned. And then she gives her whole monologue about it. Ophelia's like the way her dress is spread out under the willow tree, and it cuts back to Laertes go, so she is drowned, almost like he didn't hear anything she said after the words that your sister is dead. And it's just like that thought has just been circling in his head during her entire monologue.
Yeah, that's well played, mostly on his part. It's weird because she sort of becomes, in that moment, she becomes Polonius, where she thought, like, get to the point and that kind of thing in earlier scenes. Here, she's the one who is not brief and not really listened to either. Hamlet is a lot about mirrors, characters who mirror each other and so on. And there's a nice mirror here as well when my favorite bit from her is that Hamlet tells her her husband is a murderer, etc. At first, she seems to reject him, but then doesn't. And she has to be convinced that Hamlet is insane, so none of this makes sense. And then when she learns that Hamlet was going to be killed in England at Claudius's behest, Now she rejects him for real. So there, and she, like, when he learns that Hamlet is still alive, she's present.
She sees the surprise on his face.
Right. Like, she's looking for it. So it becomes a mirror of the mousetrap.
Yeah.
You know, it's like she's there to look into his eye and see the guilt, which is exactly what the mousetrap was about in the earlier act. I certainly like those moments. I mean, I just mentioned Polonius. We have to talk about Peter White here, whose foolishness here is very much painted as dementia.
Early onset dementia? Yeah.
That's what I mean when I say, well, I think they were inspired by True Diagnoses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went into the whatever that handbook is called, you know, and pulled some characterization there.
Polonius was my second favorite performance after Andrew Scott's.
I think so, too.
He's a tough one, and certain actors, like, I don't think they always get it across. The foolishness of him when he comes across is kind of, it's like they either play it too straight, and I don't think you can get away with that, or they play it too kind of bumbling and stupid, and that kind of makes his serious scenes or his serious dialogue kind of undercuts that. But this one, his, like, strange, like, explosions of, like, this new kind of, like, emotional scene, like, the way he just changes, and Ophelia's got to, like, okay, calm down, where's this coming from? Or other things when he's talking and he just kind of starts to ramble off and you see him kind of, like, lost. And then he's like, what was I saying? And, the way they play it, it's like, oh, yeah, he does have, like, early onset dementia or something, some other kind of mental infirmity where it just colored his character. And I was like, that is a good take on it. That is a good way of balancing the seriousness from his foolishness.
Because it's in that scene with Rinaldo, where he, you know, he tells him, like, go to France and spy on Laertes and et cetera. There's that moment that an actor must explain where he goes, oh, what was I saying? Right? It goes like that. And if you look at Richard Briers, maybe in the Branagh version, who is played more sinister, there he's going, were you listening? It was a trap. Oh, yeah. Were you listening, Rinaldo? Are you just humoring me? Where did I leave off? It's a test. Because he's that kind of paternal figure. In this case, it's a long silence. It's a long pause.
Yeah.
Where he's absolutely confused. So you start to feel for him in this way. But he's also a comedy character because in this world of hyper-surveillance, a modern hyper-surveillance, he has a bug in his lapel. This whole scene, the words scene.
Right.
Yeah, I love it because instead of having asides, he's actually talking to the king in another room listening in.
Yeah, with earbuds, yeah. And when he, like, when he first gives them to the king and queen and he just, like, he's testing it, mark the encounter. And they're just, like, kind of reacting. Oh, that was loud.
That's
okay,
loud.
I don't have to talk that close.
And he keeps going into his lapel to speak, right? So it's very humorous.
Yeah, to the point where Hamlet mocks him at the end of that scene.
Yeah, Hamlet knows what's going on. When I say hyper-surveillance, okay, sure, there's always people behind heiresses and, you know, this is that kind of play. But there's more spying in this one than in the text. Hamlet is spying on conversations that we didn't know he was in. Like, he's there to listen to the advice of Polonius to his kids, where both Laertes and him are asking her to break off the relationship. He's there. He's, like, listening in. So there's a lot more of that.
He overhears when Claudius tells Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to take him to England. He knows that before they find him.
Which is supported by the text. He tells his mother, I'm to go off to England. You know that?
Yeah.
And there's no moment where he learns this in the normal text.
And I've always loved plays where one of the themes is voyeurism or spying, which is a huge part of this one with all of, like, the way characters spy on each other or look in on each other's actions or the surveillance, as you kind of mentioned, the way they play it with the security cameras. But I really like when voyeurism or something like that is a theme of any stage play because you create another kind of depth of field, another aspect of it with the audience, knowing that the audience is watching something that they're not really a part of, that they are spying on these scenes too. I just like that kind of the other way of coloring those scenes that I just think is really nice.
Let's talk about the Polonius family because Ophelia, here she's played by Jessica Brown Findlay. She was in early seasons of Downton Abbey. That's where I knew from. The fact that because Hamlet is more in on it about the breaking of the relationship and those kinds of things, it informs his character. But it informs the whole relationship. Like, this is, like, I believe in this relationship more than in any other production I've seen. because they use, like, at the wedding, they have them dance or hug. She's there to support him in his grief. Even though there's no text there, they create that moment. And so I believe in this relationship more. And when they ask for her to break it off, he knows all about it. So it's more about eventually the betrayal where you're going along with this, with their plans, and you have betrayed me. I think it informs all those moments better than usual.
Yeah, I completely agree. And again, she's very youthful looking, kind of matching Hamlet and Laertes the way she is. I really liked the way they foreshadow her suicide in her first speech after Hamlet, kind of when she's talking about, he's like, okay, she had this breakup with Hamlet, or they fought or something, or he encountered her, because they set it up where it's just kind of in the background and they're playing a Bob Dylan song over it. And fun fact, this, we could have turned this episode into a stealth Pod Dylan episode, because there are not one, not two, not three, four, five, or six, but seven Bob Dylan needle drops used throughout this. Yeah.
Including Not Dark Yet, which was your episode of Pod Dylan that I remember.
That was my first episode. Yeah, it's my favorite Bob Dylan song.
You discussed that song, and then it's the one that plays the most.
And I don't think I like its inclusion there.
Well, we'll talk about that later. Yeah.
The song is about death, but not this kind of death. Anyway, yeah, getting back to the Ophelia of it all. When Hamlet comes to her, she's taking a bath. They have this whole little, like, strained encounter, and she kind of, and when she goes to tell her father about it, her clothes are wet. She clearly just gotten out of the bath. Her hair is wet and everything, and it's kind of clingy. She's cold. And just that image of her is like, okay, they're foreshadowing that she's going to drown. Like, Hamlet and water are going to kind of be the death of her at some point.
Yes, and the tub is also somewhere where some people commit suicide. So not to get too dark here. But one of the things about the Gertrude speech that we talked about just before is that sometimes I have this sense that there's an ambiguity because we're not shown the drowning. We're just left with Gertrude's words. How did she come about all of this storyline? Did she observe it? Did someone observe it? Did no one jump in the water to save her? It's ambiguous. And I think that performance where she has this whole thing and he goes, so she drowned? And she goes, yes, drowned. It feels more ambiguous for being cold and detached. Yeah. It feels more ambiguous. So now we pointed out this bathtub scene. Well, what if it's not a drowning? But it's kind of a drowning. But it's not a drowning. It's something that would happen in the modern day, rather than making garlands at the brook.
Yeah. She added a lot of details for Laertes' benefit, even though it was probably a much more ugly and...
Like she created this fantasy, and it's not really a drowning, but it is water-related.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I think there's something there that we can read between the lines. What did you think of Ophelia's madness?
I liked it. I don't know that I have anything more specific than that. I thought she played it really well. I love when she jumps into Laertes' arms and he's like kind of holding her up. She wraps her legs around him as she's like crying into him and then just starts crawling on him. Like at first you're like, whoa, is there a sexual component to this? But then she starts just thrashing him and he has to put her back in the wheelchair. That bit of physicality, which you don't really associate with Ophelia. I like that bit. And I thought the singing part of her, I thought the songs were good.
How should I your true love know from another one? He is dead and gone. Lady, he is dead and gone. At his head a grass green turf, at his heels stone.
I had questions about the wheelchair. It almost made you feel like there was something else wrong with her, not just depression. When she finally stands up, it's like, okay. But for a while there, she seems, so they've strapped her in or something, but she can remove those bonds pretty easily. So I just felt like that was a little confusing, unnecessarily confusing maybe.
Yeah, Ophelia, she's a hard character. It's very easy to look at her as just a pathetic victim of all of the things that the men are doing around her. And
this play in particular is very masculine. Not only are the women underwritten, they're also, there's a misogynistic vibe.
Yeah.
They are betrayers, or Hamlet sees them as betrayers. And there's a lot of lines that are anti-woman.
Yeah, he screams it too.
yeah, for sure. Both of the main leads here, of the female leads, are underwritten. And in this case, I think they brought a modernity to it where she has like a very playful sense. The kids kind of laugh at their dad. Yeah, yeah, I'm not going to take your advice. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take it with a grain of salt. She's her own person. So I feel like she's a little stronger than in adaptations where it takes place as a period piece. But let's talk about Laertes, the other part of the combo here. Luke Thompson, like I said, fun dynamic with the family. But right. At the end, he's very much broken. He's as shaky as Hamlet. I feel like he's maybe Hamlet on delay, where usually he's often played as very angry and cold at the end there. But instead of making him action Hamlet as a contrast, which is usually his role, he becomes Hamlet. I think there's one line that's very pregnant. When Hamlet jumps into the grave and says, "Who does this?" or something like that. "It is I, Hamlet the Dane." And he's pointing at Laertes. So he recognizes himself in the other. And right. From then on, Laertes is very much on the same path that Hamlet was at the beginning of the play. Kind of refuses to maybe do it. I mean, when there's the duel, he seems much more skittish about killing Hamlet suddenly.
At the same time, I think the other contrast is Hamlet, his sort of problem is overthinking his revenge and the cost of it. But Laertes is quick to vengeance. Like he storms the castle looking, and he will kill anybody he needs to in order to find out what happened to his father, even threatening the king. But I think maybe that volatility helps Claudius manipulate him more and kind of turn against him and kind of focus that anger and that rage at Hamlet. I thought he did a good job. His scene in the graveyard, I thought, set him up as a good foil for Hamlet for their final scene where they use foils. I liked his early scene, like the very beginning when he's talking to Ophelia and talking about Hamlet. And he kind of mentions, he's like, "He's been in your chaste treasure." Like, he's kind of describing, kind of like pointing down at her nether regions. And I just, the way that she kind of, they both kind of laugh at that, how awkward it is. And they made that line kind of funny, which I thought was nice.
Exactly. I mean, I think there's a fun banter between them when everything's happy. And of course, it all goes wrong. But to me, like the key moment is in the duel where normally he says, "I don't like the weight of this one, of this sword. Can I have another?" Hamlet responds, "They have all the length, right?" It's like, they're all fine.
Yeah.
And often this is shown where he shuffles the foils and picks the one that is poisoned. In this case, they don't give him another sword. So I feel like, oh, like he regrets it immediately. He has a poisoned sword and he wants to get rid of it. Right. And he doesn't want this on his conscience. Let Hamlet drink from the poisoned cup or whatever, but I don't want to do this. Which fits in better with his reactions later. Like he does eventually scratch Hamlet, and so he's the instrument of his death. But he goes back and forth, in other words. And at the end, in the text, you know, he wants forgiveness. It's like he points to the king. And so this, I think, reconciliates this a little bit better. But I do feel like at that moment, he is suddenly Hamlet, who is delaying his revenge. Are there other characters that you want to talk about in this cast? I've got a couple here.
I liked his father, the ghost. The actor also plays the player king, which is pretty common in a lot of performances. I don't know that anything really jumped out other than the way the character was used. I like the staging in the beginning, like when the flicker of the lights and the way the security cameras kind of blink off with this kind of supernatural element to it. It creates a sense of you're in a haunted house, which kind of permeates over all of Denmark throughout the play. You mentioned it, the screen, the use of screens both as backdrop and as windows throughout the play at different times. In particular, the wedding, where you can have these close, intimate scenes between Hamlet and Ophelia, or the Polonius and his kids, while in the background, and we see behind the screen, the characters are dancing, there's soft music. You kind of get the sense that this is like, yeah, they're pulling each other aside at a table or something while this festive occasion is going on. But there's a great moment when Hamlet is first talking to the people. It's when he first sees Horatio and they're kind of talking to him. He's looking at the wedding guests and we see the ghost. We see his father kind of show up in that scene.
He says, "He thinks I see my father."
Right. And then just a touch of the lighting on that glass and the father seems to vanish in a way that you wouldn't think is possible on a stage play, but it's really well done. "I think I see my father." And they're like, "Where?" And he just has this long pause. And then he's like, "Oh, in my mind." "Yeah, of course, obviously."
Must it be?
Yeah, Yeah, I thought that was excellent. In terms of the players, in terms of Horatio, other characters, fine. Nothing much. Fortinbras's character is certainly truncated. They hardly do anything with him.
He's just on screen. I mean, I don't think he had to show up, right? He's just in the news. Well, I think Horatio is not all that remarkable, I agree. But in the play of Mirrors, I don't know. It feels like they cast him because he looks a lot like Andrew Scott. Like physically just the same kind of type.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's, I thought they would do more with this, but maybe it's just a coincidence. One of the things I appreciated is that the way they cut down the lines when he does the big historical context speech at the beginning is that, oh, I understood a lot more of what Fortinbras is about from the way that was truncated.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting because I've been talking about Fortinbras a lot at the back half of this series of podcasts. It shows up in Act 5. But it does say here, like, it's very clear that, oh, yeah, I kind of forgot this and all the verbiage. They lost a lot of lands to the Danish, so he just wants his land back, which gives him, like, I have some rights in this area. So, okay, yeah, well, that was all said before. It's just, like, by the time, 4 hours later, whatever it is when you watch a play, you've forgotten all about it. The one character that I found the most interesting in the sort of support cast is Guildenstern, not so much Rosencrantz.
Okay.
But the couple is a lot more interesting than usual. First of all, they look very different. There's a white dude and there's a
black woman
playing Guildenstern there. And Hamlet shows a preference. So all the loving lines go to Guildenstern and all the mean lines go to Rosencrantz. I don't mean the character. Well, the character is yes. Like he is more of a sycophant to the king and she is more of a friend to Hamlet. But in the performance, she's the one who is shocked by his madness. She's the one who's worried. And he's kind of the jerk who's there to do the job. But Hamlet is mean to him and nice to her and much more sincere to her. And this is something I've never seen before where the joke is always that they're pretty much the same character.
Yeah.
Interchangeable. Not here.
That's the joke when Claudius mixes up their names at the beginning.
Who they are, right? That's where it starts. He still does that because he doesn't know who Hamlet's friends are. He couldn't care less.
Right.
But the way that they sort of split this up, and I don't think they changed, I don't think they sent any lines of the characters over to the other. I think this is, they're doing the play. It's just the reactions that Hamlet has to them is very different. I love that. I thought that was like, that's a game changer for me in terms of all of those sequences. And it taps into, like, we put another new female performer in the play.
Yeah.
And she betrays Hamlet.
Yeah.
Or he sees it as a betrayal.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
It fits that theme. Sorry, ladies. All right. Well, let's talk about a little bit about some of the scenes or moments. I like to call this section, Did They Nail It? So in terms of the ghost appearances, that's always a question, how you're going to do the supernatural. Here it's on stage. I thought it was pretty amazing for on stage stuff.
Agreed.
I agree with you.
Yeah, I thought all the scenes with the ghosts were great. Like up to and including the much more difficult to convey scene of in Gertrude's bedroom after Hamlet has killed Polonius when he's trying to hold their hands together. He's like, can't you see? Can't you like understand, feel like your late husband, my father? And the way she's playing it off, like, what's wrong with my son? How did he get to this state?
And he's so desperate to put his parents together.
Yeah.
He does it here and he does it in The Mousetrap. Because in The Mousetrap, when we see the dumb show, it sort of starts with a dumb show that is not the play. It's just like a prologue.
Right.
And then we get into the text or a truncated version of that text. But The Mousetrap, which is another one, Did They Nail This? The dumb show includes Hamlet. It shows Hamlet growing up. So he's really like if he affected this part of it, these aren't lines to learn, but they're certainly gestures to learn. He's making it like, this is the family that I long for, that I'm missing. So that's like an interesting wrinkle. What did you think of The Mousetrap? They sit in the audience. It's a media event. They got cameras on them that are showing up on the screen in the back. I thought this was an amazing staging.
Right. It's one of the times where like the TV production and you see them on stage as if like there's a camera, as if they're at the Oscars or something and there are cameras on them and they can talk directly to the camera, to the audience. I really liked that staging. I thought that was pretty clever. I really liked the way when Hamlet sits next to Ophelia and kind of flirts with her and it's kind of uncomfortable. It's like, oh, this is, you know, like it's deliberately cringy at sometimes. And then when Claudius storms out, like, it's so abrupt that it takes a minute for the camera to catch him. Like, the camera's not looking at him because it's not looking for it. And it's just like, whoa, 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 something happened. Turn and look. And then you see, and he's just like halfway out the door already. And you just see a silhouette, which, yeah, I thought that was interesting. The setup of them watching as the audience. And again, us as an audience watching them as an audience watching a play.
Right. It's a clever way also to have an audience there. Because if you can have Claudius react and it convinces Hamlet and whatnot. But it's much more interesting if there's an audience there. And on a stage play, you don't really have enough players to do that. So they make the audience the audience. They make the audience the courtiers.
Mm-hmm.
And they know they're being watched. They know they're being filmed. So it affects their performances and how much they can give away. And maybe it's one of the reasons that Claudius leaves is that he knows he's giving himself away. And that, you know, and then that jumps to Hamlet with the TV screen and a clicker. And he's like, he's on pause on that moment, on those eyes. You know, it's like, look, look, we can do the replay.
Yeah.
I think that was like a masterful staging for the Mousetrap. We talked a lot about all the intervening stuff, but let's talk about that duel at the end, right? So the thing that didn't quite work for you, the not dark yet playing over this, it's smothering the lines. People are actually just doing it as a dumb show. We know the play, so I think that helps, but I don't think it's mysterious what's happening necessarily. You see them say the lines even if you don't hear them. Gertrude's sacrifice is in there. I think the music, etc. I say etc. because there's like these big flashing squares. There's a referee that has his back to us and sort of hiding where the swords actually hit.
Yeah.
I think that's all supposed to cover. Maybe the fight isn't as clean as it would be in a movie. It's sort of hiding all of that. There's just like so much stuff happening that you sort of lose the fight. Is that your problem with it, or is something else?
No, it was like my issue was the use of the song, which I, again, my favorite Bob Dylan song, Not Dark Yet. The meaning and the language, like of what he's talking about, is like coming to the end of your life. There's like a kind of an acceptance of this gradual end. So on the one hand, you can see how this would inform, but like I don't think Hamlet goes into this scene suicidal, like the way he might kind of feel in other parts of the play where he might be willing to do like a murder suicide. I think at this point he is resolved to take care of business, but he's a little bit more mature, supposed to be more mature at this point. I liked the way the music, the instrumental part of the song, covered up some of the dialogue to kind of expedite that, to sort of like, okay, we know what the plan is. We don't have to see that revealed. We don't have to hear all of the rules of this. We'll just kind of go, go, go. But once you start to hear the vocals and the lines of Bob Dylan singing, I'm like, okay, this is a little bit taking me out of it. Maybe it's just because I care about the song so much. So maybe other audiences wouldn't have that problem. Yeah, my other thing is just like kind of, again, feeling like the fencing aspect of it. And obviously they mention fencing. That's it's, you can't do this scene without the swords, really. I don't, and have it make sense. But it just felt a little bit anachronistic after everything else that we've seen in terms of the modern surveillance technology and the weapons and stuff like that. And yeah, I did kind of notice, I was like, okay, I don't know that Andrew Scott and the Luke Thompson or whatever, I don't know how much time they spent actually practicing the fencing when they were rehearsing and going through the lines, because it definitely, I was like, I've seen better duels, and maybe you're right, maybe like the way that's the camera catches some of it and the referee kind of blocking it, maybe that was used to kind of cover up that, okay, this is a little bit clunky in terms of stage fighting, so we're just going to throw some things on the screen to distract you.
We have a director here, a theater director, who we immediately know her tricks, because it's, okay, if the play is kind of weak, like she's done a lot of productions at the university, like with the students, and sometimes, you know, some groups aren't as strong as others, I don't know, or maybe the play's not that great, and she smothers it with special effects. And regardless of whether the play is good or not, or the performances are good or not, there's just like so much special effects that it's distracting you from whatever other weaknesses the piece might have. This felt like that moment for me. But then it leads to Hamlet's death, which is, I thought, pretty a surprising staging idea. You've mentioned the ghost appearing. He appears several times where he doesn't in the play, right? And this is one of those times where suddenly people who are dead are standing up. The ghost has come out of the screen, the screen has opened, and they're just like, the other side would be the afterlife.
Right.
And he's receiving Laertes. Right. You have to give your watch. That's your ticket.
You have to give your watch to him, yeah, because your time is up, literally.
Right, it's kind of like the coins you would put on your eyes or something.
Yeah.
And there's all this dialogue where it's ambiguous at first if Hamlet is saying his last lines, already dead. Like, I am dead, Horatio, is how it starts. And it feels like, no, that's literally true. Like, he's died. And he's standing up just like Laertes is, just like the queen eventually walks off. You see behind Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and Ophelia and Polonius are all, you know, dancing or hugging, or they're in the afterlife together. Mm-hmm. And he's just at the gates, basically. But then Horatio comes in and he does talk to Horatio more directly. And he has like he falls over and has the poisonous death scene.
Yeah, death spasm, death throes.
I'm always a little ugh about when they do the spasms and he's still talking. The rest is silence with a quivering voice or a croak. I don't like that. I'm losing the dialogue. So here he gets a chance to do all of it and then fall into spasms. So I appreciate that. But yeah, it's like a different finish. And then we'll just cut to the TV screen. And on the news, Fortinbras has a press conference, you know.
Right, which is truncated a lot. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We don't need this piece anyway, you know, it's like, right. We can't talk about, okay, we'll put him on a stage and we'll just, he's already been dead. This is after. But I really like that staging of having the actors leave via the doors to the afterlife, the undiscovered country.
Of all of the exits, there's a long kind of stare between Hamlet and Claudius as Claudius is walking off. And his face is just kind of emotionless. But there's so much that you can possibly read between them. Like, disappointment is like, why did it go this way? Well, like, you killed me. But also, like, maybe Claudius finally just saying, like, yeah, I deserved this. This is where all my plans would eventually lead to, a resignation. But he doesn't show that in his body. It's almost just left for the audience, me in this case, to see that on his face and project that, maybe, that I was thinking. Because they really linger on Claudius and Hamlet just staring at each other as Claudius is dead and walking off.
I think he's the only one who goes to the other side of the ghost as well. Like, they're all on right, and then he leaves stage left. So I thought, okay, maybe.
Yeah.
Because why is he going to the same afterlife party as all the others?
Right,
if he's, where's hell in this? Or is it all hell? It's kind of neutral in that way. So I'd have to look at it again.
That's what Hamlet's afraid of in his second soliloquy.
So finally, just as a bulk, I guess, you said it at the beginning. You like the soliloquies. Did they nail Hamlet's soliloquies? It is a big thing. You need to nail those. There's five pieces, really. There's four major ones. There's one very short one. And I think we discussed a lot of what made them interesting to your mind. They all worked.
Yeah, and especially from the first one, he's clearly grief-stricken. He's kind of overwhelmed a little bit, both appalled and also in disbelief. Like, they're getting married already? Guys, my father's been dead. Like, it feels like, what is it, like 2 hours or something? No, it's been two months. Just so, like, beyond offended, he just can't comprehend it. And he's just so stricken by his... he's fidgety. He is actually this throughout the entire play, but like just fidgeting with his hands and just playing and everything like that. And I really keyed into that first soliloquy. I thought that was good. As I mentioned with the second soliloquy, I thought the to be or not to be speech is the best version of that speech I've ever seen. With the third one, I just really like when he kind of like sits down and he's like, the spirit I have seen may be the devil. And he's like, look, the ghost of my father is telling me to murder my uncle, the new king. He's like, and maybe that's wrong. It's like, maybe this is a malevolent spirit. Maybe I am just crazy. It's like, this could all go wrong. He's like, I need to be cautious. This course of action might be my destruction. And it's just, he has to kind of like reset himself. And that goes to part of his overthinking, that he can't act out of his own sadness. He can't act out of depression. He needs a more concrete, tangible proof. And that's kind of when he comes up with the idea of the mousetrap, and he's like, that'll catch the conscience of the king.
I mean, that one, you always have to sell that Hamlet comes up with the plan. The fact that Andrew Scott is always searching for what he means to say helps in that setting. I think the very first one, that this too solid flesh would melt, And you've got like the royals making out in the background behind the screen during the whole thing. That's the moment where I thought, oh, okay, this is going to be an interesting performance because there's just twists on certain lines. After a while, I didn't put them down on my notepad because this is like, too much. But that particular soliloquy, when he calls Claudius his father's brother, the way he does it, it suggests that he rejects everything you associate with the word uncle. That uncle is too family. It's too loving. It's too much of a relationship, and he rejects it. It's just like he finds those words because he doesn't want to use the word uncle. I thought that was like brilliant.
It is not, nor it cannot, come to good.
The cannot here sounds like a promise or a threat. It's not fate will intervene and this, you know, karmically this will turn out bad. No, I'm promising that it will turn out bad because there needs to be some sort of punishment for this. So it's like little things like that that make all the soliloquies more interesting. Same with To Be or Not To Be. The whole thing with Fortinbras or Be Nothing Worth, that one, which is the final soliloquy in Act 3. Fortinbras is just on TV and he's about to leave. So it's not done on the road where he meets a soldier or anything. It just has it with one of the bodyguards. Just the way that it's staged, I thought was interesting as well. He's just watching the news while he's packing, basically. Yes, I think the soliloquies are nailed. And also all those other monologues, you know, that he has.
The Alas, Poor Yorick one, I really like the way he just delivers that line. Like when he's holding the skull.
Alas, poor Yorick.
And he's just kind of like, you see him thinking about it. And remember, he's like, alas, poor Yorick. He almost kind of like, he looks at Horatio when he says that. He's like, can you believe it? This guy, like, this was the court jester. It's like, we grew up with this guy and like, I'm holding his skull now. I was like, how crazy is this? And then just that pause between, he's like, alas, poor Yorick. And then he kind of thinks about it. He's like, I knew him. And then goes into this whole, you know, thing about, he seems almost incredulous about it. And it's, and, but then it transforms into his, this descriptor of death, which is, yeah, I like that whole monologue too.
Similarly with What a Piece of Work Is a Man, you know, it's like those moments he's discovering, it's like there's, it's full of realizations.
Yeah.
Just the way that it's played. So I think that's what makes all of those moments shine. And very much different from the other characters who very often a more smooth delivery. And so they're liars. It's practice. That's how I feel about it. It's like, obviously, Claudius.
That's a good read on it.
He's a liar, and that's why I doubt Gertrude's story about Ophelia.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Polonius is just repeating the same advice. The kids finish his sentence at one point, you know? They're very smooth, but that's because they're fakes. And he's the only real person. He's the only person who has real thought and is really examining the situation and himself and his motivations and his feelings. So in terms of final appreciation, I do think there's a blemish or two just in the way it's the structured or, you know, but in terms of the main performance and the whole idea behind the staging, I really, really like this one.
Yeah, me too. I loved it. Like, again, like as soon as I discovered this, like I saw that second soliloquy, that speech, and then I was like, I need to watch this whole thing. Like if the whole thing is as good as this speech, I'm really interested. And then as soon as I finished it, I sent you a message. I was like, have you seen this one? If not, you should. And you should do an episode on this one. I wasn't even like necessarily inviting myself on the show, but I'm glad that you reached out to talk about this one because, yeah, this one in particular, Hamlet. Andrew Scott's performance is great, but I love the way they handled Polonius. I did like Claudius, and I like the minimal staging because it's clear that this is a stage production. This is not a movie. It is just a stage production that they did televise. But the use of the backgrounds and the minimalism, but also the technological aspects of the film and the video footage, all of this kind of just, if I was teaching this play, I would definitely use scenes from this version to help the students better understand it. I think this would be the easiest version to understand the text for kids today or a fresh audience coming in that doesn't know the work really well.
Right. It compares to Derek Jacobi, who does like spin something on each word. So, I mean, that's high praise for me. All right. Well, thanks for doing this with me today, Ryan. What are you working on these days that people might look at or listen to on the network?
Still working on Cheers Cast. It's my tour through the show Cheers, my favorite sitcom of all time. halfway through season 9 now and going strong. I'm really excited about that one. Every month, Chris Franklin and I are back to doing Batman Nightcast. You can find that one. Every month with a fifth Thursday, me, Paul Kane, and Max Romero are covering Sandman Mystery Theater on The Sandman Slept Here, which is part of the Justice Society Presents feed. All of those right here on the Fire and Water Network.
All right. Well, I'll let you slip back to the library. And that's it for this episode. If you have thoughts on this particular episode, of course, head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and let me know what they are. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWpodcasts. Thanks for listening. And I hope you'll return for the next episode of A Hyperion to a Satyr.
Good night, sweet Prince Sisquid.
The rest is silence.